The Crimes of Jack Daw by Dave Greggs, edited by Dan Sullivan. Special thanks to Solomon VK, who created and characterized the city-state of Saxur. Jack woke up to the light across his eyes. There was a weight pressing on his body, and he glanced down at the golden head of hair lying on his chest. He crooked his head and peered out from where he lay in the loft of a barn. The prairie's thick grass was bathing in the morning dew. Jack twisted away from a straw of hay which was poking him and stretched himself with a shiver to shame a rattlesnake before remembering the girl heaped on his chest. "Dear, dear, the hospitality of you simple country folk," he said, giving the girl's hair a sniff. She was deep asleep, swaddled in her salmon-colored dress, which Jack had lifted the night before after espying her making a daisy crown and approaching her for a lesson. He still was wearing this crown, but he knew he'd have to lose his shirt, which the girl was gripping tight by its broad lapel. "I'm named for a bird, but I'm more like a fish, which your cat will attest," he whispered to the girl, slipping from his loose white shirt in a single motion. City guards and underworld thugs had been left holding Jack Daw's shirts before, and he regarded a sleeping farm girl as an easy mark. "A memento of our love, dearest. Smell it well," he whispered, and made a religious symbol, before pricking his ear and glancing out of the barn once again. A ruddy, big-bellied man with ham-hock hands and a submachine gun bouncing around his body was stalking through the dewy grass towards the barn. The man was wearing a loose sash over his suspenders. It was emblazoned with crossed hose and rifles. "A brother of the armed plowman," Jack thought. "Well, I've practically married in. If I find a gun, maybe they'll let me join them, ah, my pair?" Jack whispered to the snoring girl. He then caught a whiff of bacon on the wind. It was coming from the large, whitewashed farmhouse from which the man had emerged. "Breakfast! I'm not so rude as to snuff the hostess's cooking. I shall have to time this perfectly if I'm to be served." As soon as the big man disappeared into the barn, Jack leapt from the wooden sill, landed on the wet, cool grass, and immediately rolled over 3 or 4 times with an acrobat's grace. He sprang to his feet without losing his momentum, as he was an old hand at such departures. Jack raced through the open, sparing a glance over his shoulder to be sure that the hulking farmer hadn't reemerged. Jack dove through the parallel wooden planks which made up the farmhouse's fence and rushed up to the kitchen door, sliding through the thick grass on his knees before coming to a halt against the whitewashed doorframe. Jack peered through the door window and saw a large, well-appointed kitchen where a woman in a long-sleeved gown was peeling potatoes. Jack could hear sizzling coming from a pan inside. This would be the perfect cover. Jack opened the door with a finger. "My dear, I shan't deprive you of your hearty tubers, but that fatty plowman's bacon would agree with my stomach." He slipped into the kitchen and crept past the woman with high steps like a daddy long legs. There was a thick loaf of fresh hard bread sitting on a wooden counter in the center of the kitchen, and Jack took it, ripping it open down the middle, but careful not to tear it in two. He could smell the rich white bread inside and murmured, "Oh, for rural prosperity." He sidled to a cast-iron skillet, which was frying bacon beneath the chimney. The strips were crisping around pockets of creamy fat. "Perfection! Well, I cannot abide the thought of these burning up." He picked up the pan using a dish rag and poured it, grease and all, into the guts of the bread which he'd torn open. He glanced at the woman with a look of appreciation, before noticing what lay by her knees. Jugs of fresh mead in a cabinet. "Our Simeon Patriarch is an apiarist," thought Jack with inward admiration. "I shall have to violate my own code of good conduct and discretion for a jug of Miss Rasher's Kneeside Reserve. Forgive me, Lady of the House, for startling you while you're peeling potatoes." Jack stood up, walked up behind her, and rumbled, "Excuse me, dearie." She stepped to the side without looking up, and Jack reached down and withdrew a hefty jug of mead from the lower shelf. It was wrapped in beeswaxed butcher paper stamped with a large B over a crossed pitchfork and shotgun. "Don't you think it's a little early?" She glanced at him and went pale, her mouth forming a great dark O. "Never for your cooking, my dear." Jack smiled and sprinted out of the kitchen. There was a hoarse scream behind him as he blew through the doorway. He saw the beefy farmer dragging his daughter out of the barn in a headlock, holding the submachine gun in one hand. "Unhand her, knave, and you may save your breakfast," yelled Jack, and then he sprinted for the corner of the house. The farmer raised his submachine gun with one hand and opened fire, pockmarking his wall with bullets as Jack executed a perfect sliding turn and disappeared around the corner, sailing through daisies with bread and mead carried underneath his arms as if he were a thief of babies, making for the wood line with a grin of mad elation. Jack stood at the edge of the woods, gazing upon the rolling spires of Saxherm, City of the Hills. Oh, my jewels, my crown of darkling jewels, how I yearn for you to suck me through your curves like a lusty mote on a goddess of birth. He reached down and stretched himself, warm and happy, after his morning calisthenics and a rich breakfast left over from the night before. He still had half a jug of mead, and he figured he could make it last until he'd cleared the city gates. He set off, whistling loud and merry, and eventually found a path across the bread, soft rolling furrow fields, which he knew would lead to Saxherm. The path wandered through tree tunnels hung with charms against ill intent, little scrimshaw ingots and figurines dedicated to the gods, which protected the city's farmers and other laymen. Jack plucked these from the trees as he walked, and strung them into a broad necklace, which he laid just above his shoulders like a mantle, and across his bare chest. Jack strutted into the lower quarter of Terrace Tunnel Hill like a plumeless peacock, and gazed around him with deep satisfaction at the bustle of crowds and carts as they clattered across the cobblestones. "I need a bankroll," he declared roundly to the nearest passerbys, who wore a variety of foreign garb, as well as domestic Saxherm iconography. They glanced at him uneasily, and he gave them a winning smile. "You need a shirt," one of them chided. "I want a shirt," Jack said to no one in particular. He strolled down the street, his charms clattering musically across his chest. He leapt up and grabbed a phlebotomist's hanging sign, and pulled himself up onto the cast-iron crossbar which held it aloft, balancing like a gymnast as he gazed around the street. People glanced up at him, some with annoyance, others with amusement. Jack noticed that one of the cross streets wound its way to a statue garden where small groups of richly dressed people were walking idly. "Perfect," he thought. "I'll find my way among the other natural patricians of this world, who will be taking their ease on this bright, balmy morning." Jack alighted from his roost and whistled a tune as he slipped his way through the workaday crowd. Sure enough, there in the square, Jack espied a richly appointed man on horseback. He wore a black coat hemmed in gold, white trousers, and shining riding boots which reached his thighs. The man doffed a felt-covered pith helmet with a jaunty brim as he spoke to a pair of well-pedigreed ladies in pastel dresses and enormous hats, who stood below with curvaceous greyhounds on leather leashes. That gent would have some coin to spare. Jack ducked into an alley where a young bellhop in a tweed jacket and cap was having a smoke. Jack approached him. "Spare a stick, Prefect." The young man looked Jack up and down with contempt. "Fuck out of here, jerk-off." Jack whipped a fist across the bellhop's jaw, sending a cigarette spinning into the depths of the alley. Jack caught the man by the lapels and laid him gently behind a little staircase. If anyone had seen the strike, they weren't making a fuss. Jack slipped off the boy's tweed coat and donned it, then picked up the hat from where it was lying on the stones and donned that too, and finally went and got the cigarette, placing it in the young man's snoring lips. Jack swept off his new hat and bowed. "Thank you for making that easier on me, old boy." He donned the hat again and made for the garden, walking between the statues, which were ghoulish and gargoylish and cherubic, representing the quarter's traditional spiritual overlords. They were hung with garlands, painted with harlequin makeup, had roses tossed around their feet, and so forth. Passerbys made digressions through the garden, running their fingertips across stone horns, swords, and tablets of law. The horseman Jack had spotted was approaching the edge of the crowd, and was about to re-enter the cobblestone street. Jack appraised him keenly. "There!" He had a seam in the heel of his boot, which was clad in the golden framed furniture of a long rolling spur. This was a common way to secret funds for emergency bribes. Jack sauntered up behind the man and extended a hand. The false heel was likely to have a latch or some such. The man glanced down and back at John, his eyes narrowing and darkening. Jack began rubbing the horse's haunch. "Such a beauty," he said. The man withdrew his boot from its stirrup and launched a kick at Jack's face, but he ducked it with a loosening of the knees.
"My lord," said Jack, "'twas but a gesture of affection for your mighty beast."
The man stepped down from the horse, his black velvet cloak sliding from the scrollworked leather saddle. He strode around to face Jack, brushing by the horse's tail, and drew out a double-length straight-backed dagger from a gold-lined scabbard. His cloak had patterns of coins stacked on scales. It was a marker of his profession, some kind of pure financier. Jack fell to his knees and said with breathy weakness, "Sir, I am your humble servant, your slave." People glanced at the scene, sucking their teeth or shaking their heads, but nobody stopped to help. "You like my horse, do you, worm?" the man said.
"Yes, my lord, but it is you who I now most fear and adore."
"What shall we do about this impertinence, then? You are nothing. I am everything. You wouldn't be fit to shovel Seasong's turds, urchin." The man laid the blade of his knife just below Jack's ear,
as if this was some kind of criminal knighting. People gave them a wide berth. "Sir, I am a worm. Please allow me to kiss your feet, with all of Saxham as my witness. Your serving man and footstool, until the grave takes me from you."
"I don't want your service," he said, "but you may kiss my boot, knave."
Jack placed his palms on the cobblestones and leaned his face to the man's boot. People were stopping to watch, making quiet expressions of amusement, contempt, or pity. Jack snapped his knees to his chest and grabbed the man's spur in a single motion. He leapt skyward, leaving the cobblestones for a split second, wrenching the man into the air, tearing his trousers at the crotch. The knife clattered across the stones, and the man grimaced, going red, his helmet bouncing onto the ground. Holding the golden spur, Jack deftly stabbed a finger into the latch that ran along the man's heel. It popped off instantly alongside a fat gold coin, which Jack slapped out of the air and into a pocket in one motion. "You!" the man roared, but Jack cut him off by wrenching his ankle. The man screamed, and the gaping faces around them gave a unanimous wince. Jack leapt into the saddle, kicked the horse in the ribs, and went, "Yah!" The horse took off sprinting through the crowd, which lurched out of the way. Jack could have walked away from the brutal scene with his just desserts in hand, but he'd always prefer the crowd's gaping wonder to its tacit approval. Jack arrived outside House Draper, an elite coterier serving Saxherm's rich and famous. He dismounted the horse while it was still at a trot, and then wove its reins around a lamppost. He took off the coat, removing a pack of cigarettes and a few silver coins from the pocket, then threw it in the gutter. Then he strode past the shop's bay windows and walked through the doors. He came to a stop on the broad wooden floor, taking in the scent of oiled leather and new fabric. An anxious tailor came up to him. The man was wearing an electric blue blazer, black slacks, and a raspberry cravat. He bent forward slightly at the waist and asked Jack,
"Sir, may I start you with a shirt, or shall I call the guards?"
"It's a shirt, but I'm actually picking up," said Jack. "I ordered a sash a few days ago, and it must be ready by now, mustn't it? The name was Lord Candledish."
"I shall check, sir," the man said with a grimace, and went to a locked cabinet beneath the windows.
He unlocked it, drew out a sheaf of receipts, and looked through them using a pair of lenses mounted on his nose.
Yes, right here. Have you remembered your purse, Lord Candledish?"
Jack drew the thick gold coin with a flourish, tumbling across his fingers like a playing card. "Oh, of course, my lord, please forgive my manners," said the tailor. "I shall retrieve your sash at once." He unlocked an enormous arched armoire and drew out a long, black silk and cashmere sash. It had images of lockpicks woven into it in silver thread, a tradition in Saxherm. The professional wore the tools of his trade as symbols.
"And a shirt for the master?" asked the tailor.
Something white with lots of ruffles."
"Yes, my lord."
The tailor found a white shirt that was striped ever so subtly with individual threads of silver pinstripe and had loose ruffles around the cuffs and wide collar.
"That will do. Grace me with it, young man," said Jack to the tailor, who must have been 20 years his senior.
The man slid it up Jack's arms and across his shoulders, and Jack tucked it into his snug black trousers, leaving the collar open and letting some excess fabric billow over his belt. Then the man carefully draped the lockpick sash over Jack's neck, and it came to rest around his shoulder and hip. Jack sashayed over to a spinning mirror which almost reached the ceiling.
"Ha! I look like a goddamn starling pigeon. The irony."
He drew out the coin and flipped it through the air to the tailor, who caught it with both hands cupped, holding it up briefly before taking it to a strong box chained to a countertop.
"I will bring you your change, sir."
"No need, my boy. This is the beginning of a long relationship between you and I. Buy a necklace for your lady, your catamite. But I expect that you will entertain special requests for me in the future." Jack gave the man a meaningful glance.
"Yes, of course, my lord," said the tailor, bowing his head.
"I'm off," Jack declared and strode into the street without another word, standing outside the shop with his hands on his hips, gazing up and down the street with immense pride. A man had been looking through the window, and he asked,
"You a locksmith?"
"The finest," said Jack with a grin, and breezed past him, mounting the horse and undoing the tether with the whip of his hand. Jack rode through a long, covered promenade, which served as one of the city's tacit black markets. Shops sat deep into the walls, and the place was thronged with unsavory and desperate characters, grinding out deals with the plaintiveness of one going through brick with his fingernails. Jack rode up to his favorite fence, a patrician hobbyist from the Vine Forest Principalities. The man was laying on an enormous rawhide armchair. He held an onyx cane with a golden handle shaped like a preening falcon, and wore a Chitticottian sea captain's cap. He held a long cinnabar smoking stick in his teeth, a hand-rolled cigarette languishing at its tip. and Jack smelled clove in his tobacco. "I brought you this because I know you love the races," Jack called, sauntering through the murky thoroughfare. The man grinned. "How hot is she?" Jack stood up on the horse's back like a circus boy. "Hot as hell. This is as close to her as I can stand to get." "Any bodies on her?" "None but my own. Though I did throw Lord Ass over tea kettle in my haste to take a turn on her." "Alrighty," said the fence. "Take her to the stable on the Leopard Park side of the building. Tell him Hermit sent you. I'm glad you didn't cut the saddle loose. That thing'll fetch like a dog. I'll count you out some silver, sound good?" Jack bowed. "Better than the sweetest music." Jack sat in Bistro Chevalier, situated in the highest spike of a multi-layered tower on Terrace Tunnel Hill, the finest real estate in Saxham. This place was frequented by the city's rich and by gentlemen thieves alike. The two cohorts loved to hobnob and rub elbows, discussing grand heists and cons carried out across the world. Jack was neither rich nor a gentleman thief, but he looked the part as he sat with his feet up on a voluminous cherry table, his boots rumpling the gleaming tablecloth, as he smoked the earthy cigarettes he'd taken from the bellhop. His demeanor was not incongruous for this place. Thieves, footpads, and highwaymen all leaned, stretched, and sprawled throughout the room, accompanied by adoring industrialists and real estate traders. Jack ordered a stein of wine, a rack of lamb with mint sauce and chutney, a burbling chocolate fondue with skinned apples, and a fresh-baked boysenberry tart which had been filled with chilled cheesecake. Jack cut slices of lamb, watching the chocolate burble over the rim of its high saucer, spilling in ropes over the glossy skin of the apples. He picked up the tart, held it to his nose, and inhaled lustily. A group of scarred, tattooed men in dark coats seated themselves at the table adjacent to his. He recognized this crew, a new gang of dangerous thugs called the Marlin Spikes. In the city of Saxherm, thieves' guilds and street gangs were generally disallowed by the powers that be. The city's upper crust loved the enterprise and daring of the thieves as part of its culture, but didn't want any organized criminality in the city beyond its ubiquitous black markets. Crime was to be conducted abroad, and the spoils sold in Saxherm. The fate of these Marlin Spikes was yet to be determined. They were led by a fearsome creature of nightmare, the brutal strong-arm robber Andrada Anaconda of Saraband. His hulking, lumbering murderer was said to be unkillable. He'd survived many street struggles and bore enormous scars which would have marked mortal wounds on normal men. He was absent now, which was a relief to Jack, because Andrada enjoyed brutalizing other criminals. This was a suicidal activity among normal thieves, the underworld being so prone to murders of revenge, but Andrada seemed to be immune to even the harshest reprisals. The gang was speaking quietly and solemnly amongst themselves. Jack stopped moving and listened. "What the Anaconda says goes, unless you feel like getting your head twisted off and used as a butt scrubber. Doesn't matter if he's superstitious. They sacrifice fucking kings and queens where he's from. Humor him, okay? We'll take more of this gig than we'll ever miss from what he wants to give to that fucking shrine. No gig is for sure, what I'm saying. If this goes south, we'll be swinging in the wind. No cash for bribes or bail. Nothing to get us smuggled out of town. There's always more cash. We'll be fine. We'll go to fucking war in the streets if we have to." A third cut in. "You know what I think he's thinking? Maybe he wants to make a donation, but maybe he wants to make sure we don't have anything to fall back on, so it's do or die. Like generals who burn their ships so the boys can't retreat. Admirals are the ones who have ships, dumbass. Where's this thing going down? We're going to do the ritual at Sphinxmere Shrine tonight at midnight. Some priest will be there, and we bounce. So we're just going to leave it there?" "Yeah, and if you hold out on your cut, you know Anaconda's going to pull your nasty ball sack off and smother you with it. Human sacrifice." "I get the picture. I'll have my cash. Doesn't mean I gotta like it. So who won the chariot race?" Jack's heart was racing. This was every thief's dream, robbing the donation vault of a rich temple. But this shrine wasn't locked away somewhere. It was a decorated wooden box in a back alley. The Marlin Spikes would be on a heist, and they decided to make a sacrifice first, like a bandit tribe giving a burnt offering before a raid. Jack needed that cash more than the mirror sphinx did. He'd be there. Hey there, this is Dave Greggs. I hope you've been enjoying The Crimes of Jack Daw. This is a standalone story I wrote a couple years ago, and I've been I got the whole thing recorded. I'm editing it, and I'll post it as I go. I find myself overseas for work yet again, which is amazing for garnering experiences, less so for doing deep editing, which is something I really want to spend a lot of time doing, because I have a completed work that's 870 pages, so I shouldn't say it's complete because it needs to be reduced massively. But that's sort of my main creative thrust right now, besides recording this. So we'll continue on all fronts, pushing mightily, albeit somewhat slowly. Thank you.